Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Werke, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Today is April 27th, 2021. We have four cases on our calendar today, two oral and two non-oral. First case on our calendar today is A20-1409, Gerald James Risk versus State of Minnesota. This oral argument is being held on the Zoom platform in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The same procedural rules apply to the Zoom oral argument as apply to our in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The marshal will be keeping time, and you can see the clock in the grid view, hopefully. If there's any technical difficulties, the marshal will stop the clock so we ensure that you have your full 15 minutes for your initial argument. The oral argument is being recorded by the Court of Appeals. Any other recordings are not permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. I'll ask the counsel, please identify yourself and the party you represent when you start your argument. Counsel for appellant can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Mark Kelly. I'm representing the appellant, Gerald Risk. I'm here before this court asking that this court reverse the post-conviction court's order denying Mr. Risk a hearing with regard to his claims raised in his post-conviction petition. That order can be found in appellant's brief addendum 3. And I'm going to focus first on the facts raised in that petition that justified the granting of that hearing. And I'll note for this court that that district court order is very scant in terms of the justification for denying that hearing, other than a procedural NAFLA bar, which I will address in the second half of my argument. First, with regard to the...
Mr. Kelly, so when I read the district court's order, apropos of your statement, when I read the district court's order, it looks to me that there were three reasons that the district court identified for denying the evidentiary hearing and the petition. The first is that it was NAFLA barred, that the claims you knew or should have known about the claims at the time of the direct appeal, that there was no indication in the petition that the petitioner could meet the second prong of the Strickland test. And then the third is that the ineffective assistance claims were based on the trial strategy of counsel, which are not reviewable in a post-conviction motion. And I didn't see in your brief a response to those three reasons. Do you want to address that for us, please, today?
Minnesota Statute 590.04 Subdivision 1 mandates that the trial court, the post-conviction court, must hold an evidentiary hearing unless the petition and the files and the records and the proceedings conclusively show that the petitioner is not entitled to that hearing. Now, that has been interpreted by this court that the petition needs to allege facts that are sufficient to entitle him to relief requested, and they must be more than argumentative assertions. Any doubts as to whether to hold such a hearing must be resolved in favor of the party requesting a hearing. And that's the Nix case that I cited. And a court must accept the facts alleged in the petition as true and construes them in favor of the light most favorable to the petitioner to determine whether or not a hearing is required. Now, with regard to answering the court's question, we're submitting that our petition alleged those facts, unless we are procedurally NAFLA barred. The facts that are alleged in the petition are sufficient, along with the record, along with the trial transcript, to warrant the hearing. With regard to the NAFLA bar, so that I would submit that basically the court, the district court order, when you look at it, even in the sections of how it is drafted, it says, number one, you're NAFLA barred. And number two, you didn't win ineffective assistance of counsel on the merits. But they're asking me to win that without the hearing.
Counsel, Mr. Kelly, isn't the district court really concluding that you didn't allege sufficient facts to meet the second prong of the Strickland analysis, and without alleging sufficient facts on both prongs, you haven't met the standard for a hearing?
Judge Cochran, I would agree that that is what the district court found, but that finding was an error, and that's why I'm before this court.
Well, how did the court then clearly err when it found that petitioner makes a general claim that numerous individuals would have contradicted the state's allegations, but he does not identify those individuals or say how they would have contradicted the state's allegations? How is that finding clearly erroneous?
Well, the trial transcript indicates there were other individuals present in the house at the time. Once again, I think there's two questions here, right? Whether or not I've actually rung the bell to get a reversal of the conviction. And second is whether or not I've alleged facts sufficient to get a hearing. And what I'm arguing to this court is that regardless of whether or not you reverse my client's conviction, what needs to happen today is that this court reverses the trial, the post-conviction court, and orders that a hearing be held. Now, once again, the case law that I've cited, I don't want to repeat myself, but the case law indicates that any doubts as to whether to holding such a hearing should be resolved in favor of the party requesting the hearing, and the court must accept the facts alleged in the petition as true and construe them in light most favorable to the petitioner in determining whether or not an evidentiary hearing is required. So it's absolutely true that when you file a post-conviction petition, you need to be as detailed as possible. But assuming, and that once again, citing this court's decision in Pearson from 2020, I rang that bell and a hearing should have been granted. I think what the court did was it jumped past the hearing and said, you're NAFLA barred. And if not, you haven't shown ineffective assistance of counsel because of trial strategy. And that's bootstrapping logically. I get my hearing based on the petition that I filed with the court.
How were the allegations that you're relying on sufficient to show that the result would probably have been different at the trial level?
So this court's decision is also in my addendum. I believe it's addendum 2. This court's decision on direct appeal and the record before this court, the trial transcript, indicates that there were two witnesses in this case other than my client, KT and HH. KT said that there was some bathing that occurred with HH. These are both teenage females, that there was a conduct by my client, a paddling and going into the bathroom when they were in the when they were bathing together, et cetera, and that there was sexual assault. HH testified that I was there. She corroborated some of the innocuous details of what KT said, but denied anything with regard to misconduct by the defendant. So at this point, it's these two witnesses' credibility are in the balance. Now, if there are, and we know this from the record, and I allege in my petition, there are other adults in the house, How could they not be investigated? How could they not be interviewed? They weren't even talked to. They weren't even interviewed. They weren't called as witnesses at trial. These two witnesses.
That's the whole point of us not interfering with trial strategy. The attorney may have determined, and your client may have determined that these witnesses would not have been favorable. We don't know that. That's not for us to judge. How do you get around that level? I mean, that trial strategy hurdle.
Your Honor, my brief, my petition to the post-conviction court and the evidence at the hearing would have established that they were never interviewed. They were never even, and my case law that I cite to this court with regard to ineffective assistance of counsel says that a cursory investigation or no investigation, you can't withstand a challenge as to ineffective assistance of counsel based on trial strategy if there was completely, wholly inadequate investigation. And
counsel, I appreciate that the argument is that there was a lack of investigation. And maybe there should have been some investigation. But what is missing for me is the piece that connects the, if an investigation were completed, the evidence that would have been elicited from that investigation would have changed the result, which is the second prong of Strickland. And I don't see anything in the petition or in your appellate brief that addresses that particular issue. Do you want to address that, please?
The denial of my hearing prevented me from getting those facts to the fore. And I don't know what to do with the fact that I wasn't granted an evidentiary hearing based on these allegations. It seemed to me like the post-conviction court just went to NAFLA and said this should have been raised on direct appeal. And then kind of skirted over the issue of denying me the hearing. I mean, in the order itself that's found at addendum 3-3,
well, help me out here. Why wasn't it raised on direct appeal?
So this is the analogy. All I can do is give you an analogy. And sometimes my analogies only make sense to me. But my client's life was ruined as a result of this trial. He's like a passenger in a plane that crashes. And he doesn't know until the investigation is completed, whether it's mechanical error or operator error. And this court's decision.
But essentially what you're saying, Mr. Kelly, what you're essentially saying is that there was some subjective ignorance of the law. But what authority do we have that you can argue that position now at the appellate level?
So this court's decision in Risk One provided the ineffective assistance of appellate and trial counsel argument and developed it fully. It wasn't until this court's decision, which I would analogize to the in-flight FAA investigation as to cause a crash, once the appellant, Mr. Risk, read this court's decision in Risk One, it came clear that trial and appellate court counsel were ineffective. And that is because this court in Risk One said that there may have been prosecutorial misconduct, but it didn't rise to the modified standard that needs to be raised when you don't object. So this is, you know, the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel cannot be known till the appeal is done. This is not NAFLA barred because it wasn't raised prior. The cases I cite in my brief that the state cites.
But that was my question, Mr. Kelly. What authority do you rely on to support that contention?
In my brief, I cite this case. I'm sorry, I cite this court to cases that indicate that this is ripe for appeal because it's the first time that ineffective assistance of counsel has been raised. And he's raising ineffective assistance of appellate and trial counsel. I can cite the, I can go back to my brief and look for the exact case sites. The Doppler decision is inapplicable to this fact pattern. The state relies on Doppler. And in Doppler, there is a post-conviction hearing to address ineffective assistance of counsel. There is a post-conviction hearing. And it's basically the second time up the ladder that Doppler asked for a second post-conviction hearing. This is not time barred by the statute, and it's not procedurally barred by NAFLA, because this was Mr. Risk's first opportunity to fully develop this ineffective assistance of trial and appellate counsel. And he should have been granted that opportunity. With regard to a different result on direct appeal, or a different result on appeal, it's this court's decision, once again, in Risk One, that illustrates the errors of trial counsel. Until this court issued Risk One, the errors of trial counsel and appellate counsel did not come clear. And that is because if there had been the strategy of objecting at all to this damaging Spriegel evidence, there would have been a different result. It should have been raised on direct appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Rude, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jordan Rude, and I represent the respondent in this case, the state of Minnesota. I'm asking this court to affirm the district court's decision denying appellant's petition. I'll start with the evidentiary hearing portion. Mr. Kelly did, cite the appropriate standard under Section 590.04, but what is most important here is that the district court found that appellant was conclusively not entitled to relief, and that is why the hearing was not granted. And those were for the reasons that were set out in the district court's order: the NAFLA bar, and the failure to meet the second Strickland prong, as well as the issue of trial strategy.
Isn't it rather serious, Mr. Rude? The thing is, failure to investigate a claim, and I think that's what Mr. Kelly appears to be arguing more than some of the other claims. But, if you have an attorney and the witnesses aren't even interviewed, isn't that significant in protecting a defendant's right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's certainly an important aspect of, any attorney's representation of a client. But that, again, there's multitudes of case law that refer to issues of trial strategy, which are, complex and are not always easily understood or ascertained at the appellate level. And I think that's the purpose for the case law that says that, generally speaking, appellate courts do not review trial strategy, because there are all these considerations that can go into, how far the investigation goes, what witnesses are called, and that sort of thing.
But is it really a trial strategy question? I mean, interviewing witnesses seems like a very interviewing witnesses who are present seems to be a very baseline action by counsel. What is strategic about choosing to interview the people who are present?
I don't know that we can answer that question on this record, and I think that's part of the issue that goes to the failure to allege sufficient facts in support of this petition, which the district court noted. And I would note that this, appellant could have submitted an affidavit from himself in support of his petition, saying, for example, I talked to trial counsel about interviewing these people and they didn't do it, or they never talked to me about it, that sort of thing. They could have submitted an affidavit from trial counsel or appellate counsel regarding their representation of appellant and what decisions were made or not made. And that was, those would have potentially supported this request for a petition and provided those facts that could have given more context for district court to make that determination. But, you know, at this stage, the burden is on the petitioner to allege sufficient facts to meet the standard for an evidentiary hearing and eventually for relief.
Mr. Rood, is it your position that a failure to investigate is always trial strategy that's not reviewable in an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
And let me add to that if I can. What should he have done, appellant counsel? What should Mr. Kelly have done? Should he have brought one of these persons that apparently allegedly were present but weren't interviewed and allege what they would have said? What should he have done?
To answer Judge Cochran's question, I think that it's not a sort of bright line. It's always this or always that situation. I think that it does depend on the context of the case and what information is available in the record or is alleged by the petitioner. And to answer Judge Workey's question, I think that, for example, providing an affidavit from one of these potential witnesses saying, I was never talked to, here's what I would have said, here's how it might have led to a different outcome at trial. That's the information that was lacking and that would have supported this petition. I did want to address.
So what facts here indicate that this was a matter of trial strategy? That we should conclude that it was a matter of trial strategy.
I think, as Mr. Kelly pointed out, it's apparent from the record. I believe the transcript that there were other people present in the house. It's which. And shows us that trial counsel would have been aware that these people
were
present.
But is there, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So we could have brought it up on direct appeal, is that what you're saying? These people were there, defendant, now appellant, knew they were there, so why didn't he bring it up at direct appeal?
And that goes to the NAFL issue, Your Honor, which I would like to sort of separate the trial counsel claims from the appellant counsel claims on this issue, because appellant has raised issues concerning his trial counsel and his appellant counsel. And all of the issues regarding trial counsel were known or should have been known at the time of this direct appeal. These were, the investigation or lack thereof, the objections or lack thereof. These were all things that happened prior to or during trial. Appellant would have known that they happened or didn't happen, as the case may be. Appellate counsel, current counsel, but counsel on the first appeal, would have known that these things didn't happen from the record. And all that information was available at the time of that direct appeal. This court's opinion in the prior appeal in this case did not, reveal any new information to anyone. This was, this court applied, standard well-established law to the facts of the case. It's not an issue of some new revelation that would not have been apparent before the opinion was released. But I do want to separate, the district court did not procedurally or NAFLA bar appellate counsel claims. And that's not what the state is arguing either. That was the second half of the district court's opinion that held that the appellate counsel claims were without merit for those two or three different reasons. So I did just want to make that distinction. The NAFLA bar applies only to the trial counsel claims, and the district court did properly consider the NAFLA standard in making that decision.
Mr. Rood, I'd like to discuss whether the NAFLA bar properly applies to the failure to investigate claim. Because case law establishes that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel is not barred by NAFLA if it cannot be determined by the district court record and requires additional evidence. And it's not clear to me that the district court record here is sufficient to address the failure to investigate claim. Is there any evidence in the district court record regarding counsel's efforts to investigate, to and to interview additional witnesses? Or is that something that would require additional evidence that should have been addressed in a post-conviction petition?
The record is pretty scant on that issue. I think that, you know, obviously the record does tell us, you know, what witnesses were called or what trial counsel did do, but there's not a lot of information about, you know, what was not done, sort of.
How could it have been raised in a direct appeal effectively?
I think that goes, I think, towards appellant's argument that appellate counsel should have requested to stay the initial appeal and move to a post-conviction petition, which then goes to the determination of the merits of that claim. Finding that that claim was not procedurally barred then takes us to the next step, which is, you know, was there enough information to establish that appellant could prevail on this claim or could earn an evidentiary hearing? And that's where the issue of a lack of sufficient facts or supporting facts comes into play. So I think that sort of second step is where the claim still fails.
So you would agree then that the failure to investigate claim, at least that portion of the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, may not be a NAFLA bar?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
But it would still wouldn't justify a hearing because there isn't sufficient evidence to show to meet there. And I shouldn't say evidence. The allegations aren't sufficient to meet the second prong of the Strickland analysis. Is that your argument as I understand it?
Yes.
And that the district court judge correctly, or the record supports the district court's determination in that regard.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right.
To follow up on Judge Cochran's question, the failure to allege sufficient facts or make sufficient argument on the second prong of the Strickland test, your argument is that that's fatal to both the ineffective assistance of trial and appellate counsel claims.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
If there are no further questions from any of the panel members, I would ask that this court affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rood. Any rebuttal, Mr. Kelly?
The appellant agrees with some of the comments of the court and counsel that appellate counsel could have asked for an evidentiary hearing on direct appeal. And his failure to do so is what we submit is the inadequate appellate counsel. With regard to the second prong of the Strickland test, which this panel is focusing in on, I once again would submit that I'm a little bootstrapped when it comes to showing that the result would have been different, other than this court's ruling in Risk One, which indicated that this higher standard, plain error, was going to be attributed to the prosecutorial misconduct claims, and that decision triggered some of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. How do I show that the results of the proceedings would have been different but for counsel's errors? I can only reiterate that there were two competing teenage female witnesses at trial, one which completely exonerated my client of wrongdoing and was ostensibly, according to the record, present at all times. The other witness at trial, the alleged victim, was in contradiction to the testimony of HH. When you have a case that hangs in the balance like that, and a standard of proof of beyond a reasonable doubt, there is no justification for failure to call the other people present in the home at the time of the crime, to not even interview the other people present in the home at the time of the crime.
Mr. Kelly, does the record reflect that trial counsel, or is there an allegation that trial counsel did not interview any of those witnesses that point me to that in the record?
Well, that was certainly alleged in my petition. Okay. And citing Pearson, the court must accept the facts alleged in the petition as true and construes them in light most favorable to the petitioner to determine whether or not a hearing should be granted.
So, correct. So, but there isn't any allegation as to what those potential witnesses would have testified to, right? That next step, that next piece is missing, correct?
In my petition, I indicated that they would, if called, they would indicate that they were present and heard no such commotion, they were present in the home at the time, and they would have corroborated HH's testimony, which I would tip the balance in my client's favor.
And explain that to me. How do those allegations show that the result would have been different, that there wouldn't have been a guilty verdict, that the result probably would have been different?
Yeah. I would submit two parts. I would answer the court's question in two ways. Number one, that tips the credibility balance in favor of HH and erodes substantially the ability to prove a fact beyond a reasonable doubt that my client committed this crime. But also, you combine that with what this court found in Risk One was objectionable Spriegel evidence, and those two facts would create a different result. I'll tell the court that by definition, I would submit to the court that by definition, a petition is an assertion of facts which, if proven true, justify the relief. So in a petition for post-conviction relief, I'm asserting those facts which, if established at the evidentiary hearing, would justify the relief. And I believe that we did that. And I would submit to this court that that evidentiary hearing should have been granted. I'm not asking this court on a threshold issue to find the ineffective assistance of counsel and reverse my client's conviction. I'm finding this court to reverse the post-conviction court order denying my evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Excuse me. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments.